This is Virginia Insights. I'm Tom Graham. In his new book, Larry Lamar Yates traces the term scalawag to post-Civil War America. Back then, it meant a white Southerner who joined forces with the North once the Confederacy lost. So we'll certainly ask Larry why he takes such pride in today calling himself scalawag. But mostly we've asked Larry to revisit with us because he's probably the most ardently left-wing activist who's ever appeared on this program. And maybe you've noticed lately, terms like leftist, liberal, and socialist have been getting tossed around like so much political confetti. So hearing how a true leftist sees things might be educational. It also gives us a chance to ask how you view left-wing and right-wing, where you place yourself on that spectrum, and why. By the way, Larry's new book is titled The Scalawag Scholar's Notes on Virginia, and you're certainly welcome to ask him about that too, right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. This is not a test, so please don't feel you have to write any of this down. But there are a whole bunch of questions with which I was hoping you might be able to help. Left wing, right wing, extremist, socialist, far right wing agenda, far left wing philosophy, even liberal or conservative. Do these terms mean anything to you? Or are they just something we toss out these days when we disagree with the other guy? When it comes to left, right, and center, do you see yourself as falling somewhere on that political continuum? And if you do, how'd you get there? 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our phone number. In all numbers, 888-967-2825. After more than 30 years of covering politics, I have to admit that some of the titling that I've heard lately, calling the current administration in Washington extreme left wing, has just struck me as rather silly. Whether you agree or see things completely differently, I really do hope to hear from you. And while we wait for you to get to the phone, we begin with a chance to hear what a true left wing activist has to say about his view of what it means to be on his end of the political spectrum. He has just published two new books that we will be talking about a bit later in the program. But we start simply by welcoming from Winchester, Virginia, Larry Lamar Yates. Larry, it's so great to see you back in the Insight Studio.
Good to be here, Tom. Thank you.
So from where you sit, what is a leftist?
Well, it's fundamentally to me, and it goes back to just where people sat in the French General Assembly in the 1790s, the radicals sat on the left, conservatives on the right. To me, it's a spectrum, and the farther left you are, the more you are concerned with social and economic justice, concerned with working people, poor people, and their power, with basic ideas of fairness. The more you are to the right, the more you're concerned with protecting the existing institutions and the existing people who are in power. So that's how it looks to me.
One of the things that you've stressed to me in the past, Larry, is that you don't want anyone to think that you think that in describing your views, you speak for everyone who considers themselves on the left wing. That these are your own interpretations, although you feel many on the left agree with much of how you see things.
Well, I know people who don't even think I'm a leftist, So, yeah, that's very much true that everybody has their own take on this.
How do you feel about the analysis that says people on the left are interested in using government to solve problems? People on the right are interested in keeping government out of interfering because, from their view, government causes problems.
I think it's a misunderstanding, really, at best. At worst, it's hypocrisy. Government essentially is that organization which has the power to put us in prison or kill us. That's what government is. If it doesn't have that power, it's not a government. It's just a social service agency. You know, everything else that government does, somebody else does. But the one thing government can do, nobody else can do, is say, this is the law. If you don't obey it, you're going to be punished. So that's the definition of government. By that definition, you know, big government is big military, big police, big prisons. That's big government. And in those terms, first, we have a huge government in this country. We have the most powerful government that's ever existed in terms of its ability to kill people and imprison people. And the people who call themselves small government conservatives are the biggest cheerleaders for this big government. So, you know, I think it's those people tend to be critical of government doing certain very specific things. Back 50 years ago, they said, well, government shouldn't be integrating the schools. You know, now they say, well, government shouldn't be helping poor people because, you know, then we have to pay them more for them when they get a job. Those are very minor things that government does. The big thing that government does in terms of money and in terms of power is to exercise real power over our lives, compulsion.
There's only 7 questions in my head at this moment. I was just counting to see how many there were.
Sure, no problem.
Then I was trying to pick one. You moved from considering yourself a liberal as a teenager to where the term liberal was no longer left-wing enough for you. So tell us about that transition. Actually, tell us about how in your mid-teens you became so politically engaged that you thought of yourself as a liberal, where I suppose many 14- and 15-year-olds today aren't thinking much about politics at all.
Well, a lot of it came, of course, from my family. That's pretty typical. My family was concerned about these issues. My father was, not an activist, but he had strong political opinions. But in particular, we lived in Southeast Asia. My father was a teacher over there. He was training English teachers.
You were in Saigon as a young boy.
That's correct.
Kind of in between the wars in the late 50s. Before the U.S. came in after the French had left.
1957, 1958, that's correct. And my father observed the beginnings of the American buildup, and he didn't like it. He thought it was misguided. He thought it was going to fail. He had a take on the Vietnam War that turned out to be correct long before most people.
And what was that take?
That take was that this was a mistake. They were supporting a corrupt South Vietnamese government. In the long run, it wasn't going to work.
And yet your father was in Vietnam at that time.
Right.
Kind of an emissary of the U.S. government. Was he teaching English or teaching other people how to teach English, something like that?
He was overseeing people teaching English. So, yeah, I mean, I guess he's thought of that as a pretty benign activity, you know. But he saw other people, the military, he saw police advisors who were doing. In other words, he didn't see anything wrong with being in Saigon or Bucharest or wherever and helping people to learn English. That's good for them and good for the United States.
And then after your family left Saigon, you went to someplace else in Southeast Asia?
We were in Bangkok for 5.5 years in Thailand.
And then you're in your early teens when your family moves back to the States?
14 years old, I came back to Fairfax County here in Virginia.
Because your father was working in D.C.?
Yeah, he actually worked for the State Department Language School. So there are some contradictions in his life. But
so you're age 14. You come back to Virginia. Are you already something of a political activist?
Well, I was living in another country, you know, and I don't think it's, you know, with very rare exceptions, it's not appropriate. And again, I was pretty young. But when I got here, there was a lot going on. First, in relation to the freedom movement. The first issue I got involved in was the issue of fair housing.
So, and remind us of time frame. Is this like mid-60s?
65,
okay.
Something like that.
So you're 14, 15 years old, and you come back to the U.S., and based on what you see compared to what you saw in other cultures where you had been growing up, you felt it necessary to get involved in political activism.
Well, my father actually took me to these meetings, but clicked. It clicked with me. I wanted to do it. When I had lived overseas, while I wasn't living, you know, right in the local population, I had a lot of interaction with people from other cultures. I went to a school that was what we would now call multicultural. So I had a very firm idea that it didn't matter, you know, what your race or ethnicity was. You know, my first girlfriend was Chinese origin, but the best teacher I ever had was Thai. You know, so the idea that all people were equal and deserved equal treatment just made sense to me.
And did that relate to this housing concern that you say you got involved in?
Yeah, absolutely, because the idea of fair housing was just anybody should be able to live where they want to live, they can afford to live. Now, we have to remember that under Virginia law at that time and until 1968, it was perfectly legal to discriminate in housing. You could put a sign, you know, a for sale sign to whites only. That was legal in Virginia in 1966, 1967.
And at the age of 14, 15, 16, you objected to that?
Absolutely.
And we're also talking about the time where the American involvement in Vietnam, what is going very obviously from a police action to a war, was stepping up. You're getting closer and closer to draft age. Is this affecting you?
Yeah. I mean, first, the impact of the actual war. Again, I'd seen these people, you know, when you...
The Vietnamese.
Southeast Asians, you know, so when you have a village burning down on television, that's not an abstraction to me, you know, at the age of 16, it's not an abstraction. You know, a lot of people were morally outraged or whatever. It hit me in the gut. You know, it's like if you saw your hometown being burned down, you know, so it had a very powerful impact on me. Now, as the draft came along, I had to make some kind of decision. I happened to be to get into college when I was 17. I was finishing my first year of college when I turned 18. I finished it successfully, and then I said, I'm not going back because I don't really believe that I have a right to the student deferment. I disagreed with some other people who are now politically active.
And it's going to get us off track a little bit if we get too far into it, but we should mention that you did find a way to persuade the U.S. Army not to draft you. And you got, at this point, I guess you're considering yourself a leftist. You got involved with Students for Democratic Society,
right,
in the Washington, D.C. and Northern Virginia area. And by this time, you no longer consider yourself a liberal. You're now a leftist.
Right, because I'd been opposing, you know, Lyndon Johnson was a liberal. He was a consummate liberal, and he did a lot of good things, but it was his war that I was opposing.
Longtime political activist and community organizer Larry Lamar Yates is our guest, if you've just joined us on this edition of Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham, and we're going to be looking a lot at political labeling during the upcoming hour, but we're making sure that we get some of Larry's backstory first. Let me repeat that if you have a sense of what different political labels mean and why we use them today, or where you fall on the political continuum between right and left and why you feel comfortable there, we'd love to hear from you at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. There were a fair number of people back in the 60s and into the early 70s who were in the age group that we've been talking about you being in, Larry. Very politically active then. They later became stockbrokers and car salesmen.
Actually, that's a fallacy, Tom. There's actually been a study done by a guy named Richard Flacks, F-L-A-C-K-S, of what happened to activists, people who were genuinely activists in the 60s. They didn't become stockbrokers. They became teachers. They became social workers.
But you know, many of them lost the connection to political activism that you have kept in your life for more than 40 years.
Right. That's true. All I'm saying is they didn't go all the way to the dark side. I've stayed a little more consistent than a lot of people.
There's an obvious question about why, but we have music playing, so you know that means we've got a break coming up here. It's only a minute long. We already have some questions coming in on Facebook. Eric, your question on Facebook is going to be first when we get back. And for anybody who feels like they might want to share their voice with us, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-967-2825. We'll be back in just a bit more than 1 minute. Larry Lamar Yates traces his political activism back more than 40 years. 40 years to the late 1960s, when he was doing community organizing in Northern Virginia as a member of the group SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. After the Vietnam War, Mr. Yates moved to the Richmond area, engaging in a variety of liberal causes, many of them having to do with fair housing. Today, he is based in Winchester, Virginia, but continues involvement in left-wing activism across the Commonwealth. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And we are looking at the topic of political labeling. By the way, have you listening yourself ever in the past or even now active in some sort of political organization or community cause? We'd love to hear your perspective about that experience by phone at 888-WMRA-TALK. If you once were much more concerned about politics than you are today, what changed? If you only just recently became politically active, how did that come about for you? 888-967-2825. In your view, Larry, as somebody who makes no bones about the fact that you see yourself as a left-winger, has political discourse changed significantly in the U.S. over the past 40 years?
Absolutely. It's changed because of the freedom movement, the civil rights movement, which, you know, really broke up the consensus of the 50s and early 60s, not only for black people, whose lives obviously were substantially changed, but other groups, women in particular, people with disabilities, neighborhood leaders, gay and lesbian folks. A lot of people learned from that experience. You know, even to some extent, those who oppose abortion learned from the experience. So what the freedom movement did is it not only changed the legal conditions under which black people live, but it changed the idea of democracy from, you know, well, we go and we vote and we do what our leaders say all the rest of the time to, you know, I deserve to have a say here. I deserve, as just a regular person, as, you know, a sharecropper in Mississippi was about as low on the totem pole as you get, you know, I deserve to have a say in my life. And I think that has really changed the country a lot. Now, it also bothers a lot of people. A lot of people are not happy with it. So it's polarized the country. But
well, here's what Eric on Facebook has to say about how he's viewed what's changed in recent history. Quote, I think the entire political spectrum has shifted noticeably to the right in the past two decades, starting with Bill Clinton moving the Democratic Party to the center in order to win the 1992 election. The ideologues in the Republican Party were perfectly happy to respond to that by taking their own step further to the right to maintain some daylight between themselves and the Democrats. As a result, 20 years later, what used to be considered conservative is now moderate, the former moderate is now liberal, and the erstwhile liberal is dismissed as a socialist. Fair analysis, Eric?
I think that's an accurate statement about the spectrum that the media and conventional politicians see, that spectrum has moved to the right. I don't think it applies to the whole country. I don't think it applies to the average person. I think the political spectrum of the average person has moved substantially to the left. I mean, they were even talking about rights for gays and lesbians is revolutionary. That so many things the feminist movement fought for are now accepted by a vast majority of people. I mean, one of the things is wife beating. You know, when I was a kid, it was okay to beat your wife. You know, that was perfectly acceptable. Now it's totally not acceptable for almost everyone. So that was a political change. So I think, again, the spectrum at the grassroots has moved one direction. The spectrum at the top where, you know, the people in power have some control has moved in the other direction.
Self-described left-wing political activist Larry Yates, our guest, 888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. From Scottsville, Marissa, thanks for using that number and calling in. Your question or comment for Mr. Yates, please.
Well, hi, thanks so much. I'm really glad that you guys are doing a show treating this topic, and I'm very glad to hear someone that's very proud of and not afraid to say that he's a leftist, because I feel that in the political forum today, liberal has a very negative connotation, and it's widely just accepted that that's a negative adjective. And I find that to be very frustrating, because I feel that liberal, actually the liberal, perspective and opinion is actually a very moral and just way to look at the world.
Well, Marissa, thanks. I certainly agree that liberal and radical approaches are more moral in that they take more concern for the people who are oppressed or in trouble. You know, the right-wing approach tends to be more concerned about the privileges of those who are in power. I would disagree that this is, the case everywhere. I think what you're talking about is very real, but it's happening in the media, and it's happening in the minds of the people who are really focused on the media. I'm not sure that if you look at the entire country, this is actually the case. For instance, we see a lot of people moving away from the church because they associate the church with right-wing ideas, particularly younger people. So I frankly don't think that's the right thing to do,
Right. Well, I mean, I hope you're right. I guess I feel like the media is such a pervasive voice in the culture, and it may not be as real as it seems to be. I don't watch TV, but I do, I do sense from people around me, the sort of right-wing radio shows and the, the sort of the cable news stations definitely at least act like they have more presence than hopefully they do. But
Marissa, may I ask you a question?
Yeah.
You used some terms before that I was trying to mark them down, and I didn't write fast enough, because I'm interested especially here in people's definitions of what some of this terminology means. And I think you said that in your view, liberal means something about justice and something else?
I said moral and just, it's more concerned with, it was more, there's a lot of morality, I think, in the liberal perspective. And also we're very concerned with justice for all.
Okay. Thank you so much for sharing your perspective.
Yes. Thanks for taking my call, and thank you for doing this. It's a really interesting topic.
Next to Harrisonburg, Dale, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for political activist Larry Yates, please.
Well, first of all, I want to say hi to Larry. He's an old colleague or friend of mine. My comment has to do with one of the derogatory terms used to label liberal people. It's called a bleeding heart liberal, which really makes me proud, because it is associated with the picture of Christ and his heart is bleeding. So I find it ironic or maybe hypocritical that those on the far right like to label us as bleeding hearts, and they tend to profess to be Christians. that hypocrisy I could go on and on about in other areas, but I just really wanted to make that comment. And Larry, I hope you're wearing a flak vest.
Thanks, Dale. I think in a lot of ways, leftism, socialism, which we haven't really got to yet, is a response to a radical idea that came along in the late 1700s, early 1800s, and that's the idea of laissez-faire capitalism. It never existed before that time. The idea, this is mine, I earned it, and I get to keep it, was an idea that didn't exist in any society until Britain in the late 1700s. And when that idea came along, people reacted to it by saying, wait a minute, we've always had certain rights. We've always had a certain idea of justice. Sure, we were under a king, and that was pretty bad in a lot of ways, but we still had certain rights. And now you're going to say only money counts. That's unacceptable. So,
I realize, Larry, that you've written this book, The Scalawag Scholar's Notes on Virginia, which is a look at over about 400 years of Virginia history. And in some ways, you consider yourself a self-taught historian.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't want to spend a lot of time challenging your view, because I ask you here to share your view and mm-hmm. then invite the audience to respond. Mm-hmm. But as long as so far all we have are people calling in to support your point of view, every once in a while I'm going to have to say, well, didn't we, for example, have people in the 1300s and before who may have lived in what today is Spain or Germany or somewhere in Africa who were ruled by people who considered those residents peasants mm-hmm. and different kinds of feudal systems mm-hmm. where you had no right to own property. And in fact, in some of those societies, you were the property of the feudal lord. Well, so how can you say that the idea that taking stuff and owning it as mine mm-hmm. is something that only came up in close to modern day Britain? I mean,
it's pretty straightforward, really. In that period you're talking about, and I'm certainly not defending everything about that period. There were a lot of things wrong, and you know, the left, as you say, began in the French Revolution, which was not exactly pro-monarchist activity. But the idea that I personally, as a business person, you know, this whole I built it kind of thing, own anything was really unacceptable. Not just in Europe, but in all other cultures, the idea was that the whole society essentially owned everything, and ultimately God or the gods owned everything, that you didn't have personal property beyond what you could carry or what you used in your everyday life. You know, the idea of building up money in large quantities, I mean, you can see it in the New Testament, you know, the idea of the Jubilee year, the idea that, you know, you return your debts, and even stronger, of course, in what Jesus said. You know, you can see that, in fact, these were distributive societies. These were societies where the fundamental value, and there's, I don't want to get too esoteric either, but there's a writer named Polanyi, P-O-L-A-N-Y-I, who writes about this, writes about the anthropology of economics. You know, we tend to think that what we have now is what always existed. But the fact was, for instance, throughout medieval Europe, there was a set price of bread all the time. Every year, and often it stayed the same for a century or more, you know, and you couldn't sell bread for more or less than that. That was the way it was. Now, again, I certainly agree with the other comments you made about the bad old days, but you didn't have this idea of private property in a laissez-faire market. That's a new idea, and that can be very clearly established historically. And it was a shocking idea. Business people in the Middle Ages in Europe were considered, you know, very lowly characters who were not of any real importance and were not respected. You know, you're much better off having your son be a monk than having your son become a banker from the point of view of respectability.
Dale, thank you so very much for your call. And again, I just want to double check. Did I receive correctly that it is your view that when you hear the term bleeding heart, that's a very positive thing because it reminds you of a part of Christianity that's important to you?
Well, I think it's because it's a symbol, and it's a very big Christian symbol. And I hate to stereotype, because I know there are people on Christians who are on both ends of the spectrum, but you mostly hear and see and experience about, in the right wing, people who consider themselves Christians or fundamental Christians. And so I just find it interesting that they would use something that's connected with Christ as a derogatory term toward people on the left. Just two more comments, if I might, before I leave. One on this idea of on economy and, you know, keeping what is yours. Again, I like using the Bible as ammunition for these sort of ideas. And there's a quote in, I believe, in Matthew about how you treat the least of these, my brethren, you do to me, you know, which is saying that we should have compassion for people who have less, and we should be trying to help them. And my other comment is that I feel, even particularly in this political atmosphere, that you could almost label the left as positive thinkers, people who are looking for good, whereas the Republican side, they're always talking about fear and anger and negativity. So thank you very much.
Dale, thanks so much for your call.
And I would just real quickly want to dissociate myself from the Democratic Republican spectrum, because I don't really consider myself to be, you know, a Democrat either.
888-WMRA-TALK is how to reach us by phone. On Facebook, we are listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Left wing, right wing, extreme, moderate, or most any other political label we hear today. Do such terms have meaning in your view? Willing to tell us about that view? Or maybe chip in a related topic that you have not yet heard addressed? 888-967-2825. From Harrisonburg, Ray, thanks for calling in. Your question or comment for political activist from the left side, Larry Yates, please.
Hi, how are you doing today?
Good.
Howdy.
I have to somewhat almost ashamedly admit that the point that was made earlier about people's individual views moving slightly right, while the perception is that society's views are moving right.
Yeah, that was Eric on Facebook.
Yeah, I have to kind of admit that my views, I was always a diehard Republican, which I guess is the conservative counter to the bleeding heart liberal. And my views have moved a little bit farther left. I think the problem that the left has with gaining some of us conservative voters or conservative people of those viewpoints is the fact that, like the past caller said something about conservatives being, viewing liberals as bleeding heart liberals, but they're supposed to be Christians. I think the bad thing that liberals have to deal with is people can't get over the fact that you have a liberal who is against the death penalty for a hardened criminal, but has no problem, in some viewpoints, putting a child to death through abortion. How do you equate those, or how do you justify those two views?
Well, again, this is Larry. I'm not speaking for everybody by any means. Personally, I do oppose the death penalty and have for a long time. I respect those people, and a lot of them are Catholics, who have the seamless garment approach. That is, they oppose the death penalty, they oppose abortion, they oppose euthanasia, they are strongly in favor of doing whatever you can for the poor. These nons from Network and other groups who just drove around the country. I have a lot of respect for them. I've worked with them.
Right.
For me, the issue on abortion, and it's never been an issue that I've worked on real hard, but I do have a pro-choice position. The issue for me is that there's a woman here who's got a very difficult decision. I've had friends who've had abortions.
Same here.
And it's not an easy thing for anybody. And for the government to come along and say, okay, this is the right choice, this is the wrong choice, I don't like that. And I think it's done to protect men and not to protect the embryo, the fetus.
We have to pause for the break. Ray, it seems to me that there's an essence of your question that still ought to be addressed. So if you can stay with us, I'd like to see if we can get Larry to do that when we continue in a bit more than 1 minute. To you on the other side of your radio, if you are a parent, is politics something you have ever spoken to your children about? If you have adult children, how have you observed their views changing over the years? If your kids are still fairly young, have you found yourself concerned about all the name-calling going on in modern-day political discourse and what your kids might be thinking about that? 888-WMRA-TALK is our phone number, 888-967-2825. And we do have a couple of phone lines open right now, but I think we still got Ray on the line. And Ray, if I understand, what struck me as one fundamental essence of your question is, how can you oppose the death penalty and allow abortion? Isn't there some sort of moral mismatch there? Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Hold on just a second, if you would.
Sure.
If that's a fair summation, Larry Yates, of the point of view of many who oppose abortion, what's your response to that?
Well, Ray, I would say that my analysis as a radical, again, not a liberal, is I look at power. I look at who's in power and what they want. And my observation on this abortion issue is that the wealthy have always been able to get abortions, and they always did get abortions. And they always will be able to get abortions because you can always fly to wherever. You know, so the question here is who is actually being prevented from getting abortions? And first, again, I don't think any woman chooses abortion just because she's in that mood. You know, maybe there are a few, but I've never met them. So the people that are being prevented, or where it's being made more difficult for them to get abortions, are the people who, you know, have to go to a clinic that's Planned Parenthood or someplace that's subsidized. And I'm thinking, who wants to interfere in the reproductive lives of those women? And Virginia history, it's not that long ago that the same women were being sterilized, you know, which I oppose just as strongly as I oppose, you know, taking away their right to have an abortion. So, I would say that this is a very difficult question. And I certainly, if people who are totally consistent and oppose any kind of violence, I respect them. And I've worked with them a lot. I like them. People who support the death penalty and oppose abortion, I got nothing for them. You know, but for people who really genuinely take that seamless garment approach, I respect them, but my position is slightly different because I'm looking at who's in power, you know.
Ray, thank you so very much for your call. Before we go on to Anna in Charlottesville, let me just double check. Is it from your point of view as a left winger, Larry Yates, that what would be more equivalent is a government that engages in executions such as the death penalty,
mm-hmm.
and a government that forced women to have abortions?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, but, and not equivalent, but certainly both. You know, again, I feel like I'm more opposed to big government in reality than most people on the right are. And that would be, both of those would be examples of big government. But again, a very real example here in Virginia. Women were being sterilized. Those were poor women. Those were women of color. They were being sterilized. There's still a lot of people living today who were sterilized by the government of Virginia.
I really do want to make time, Larry Yates, to talk some about your two new books. But we've got so many calls, so let's see if we can get through some of these that all of a sudden just came in. Anna in Charlottesville, you're on Virginia Insight with Larry Lamar Yates. Your question for him, please.
Good afternoon. I am one of the seamless garment Catholics,
mm-hmm.
Who identifies herself as a liberal. In fact, I was a card-carrying member of the ACLU for many years until they made abortion such an important part of their platform.
Mm-hmm.
I find it very difficult, the whole idea of labeling with liberals, conservatives, etc., because there are many people like myself who are liberal, perhaps in many of their social justice views and many of their opinions with regards to many social issues, but are also take positions that are considered very conservative with regards to abortion and the death penalty and that sort of thing. And so I wonder if you have any thoughts about what might be more descriptive instead of, you know, liberal, conservative, Republican, Democrat, especially for those of us who aren't really either one exactly. Thank you.
Right.
Thank you, Anna.
Yeah, thanks. Well, first, again, I want to say one of the things I'm known for is arguing with, you know, some of my more secular friends about the value of a lot of Catholic doctrine. And I've worked with a lot, particularly a lot of women religious over the years, and have an enormous amount of respect for them. And that's, I will say, I've said that many times off the air, believe me. I think that the labels that are being used now in a lot of ways are way past their due date. that we stopped really having liberals and conservatives in mass quantities. What we have now is we have reactionary rightists who are organized very consciously by people like the Koch brothers and people who run Fox News around a party line. And then we have people who belong to the various progressive and radical movements or identify with those movements. And then there's some people maybe like you who are kind of somewhere else, and that's fine. You know, it's not like everybody.
I'm sorry, because just we're not getting calls from the other side, so I'm going to have to call you in this, Larry.
Okay.
It sounds to me that I'm getting the flip side from you mm-hmm. as somebody who says that he's on the left.
Mm-hmm.
From what I get when I talk to people who say they are on the right.
Right.
And in your case, it is right-wing, bad, immoral, left-wing, good, moral. And when I talk to those people, it's mm-hmm. my side, good, moral, mm-hmm. those guys over there on the other side, bad, immoral.
Well, I didn't use those words first. And
but
no
you certainly are being negative about the point of view of people who disagree with you and why they disagree with you.
They're reactionary.
They're being fooled by the Koch brothers, or they're all coming together as sheep. Isn't that what you're saying?
Tom, I think you're adding a lot of words that I didn't say. As individuals, I don't think there's any difference in morality. You know, whether you're on the right or you're on the left, you know, moral people are moral people, and every group, every political group has immoral people, amoral people, and moral people.
So you can oppose abortion, you can vote for right-wing Republican candidates, and still be a moral person in Larry Yates's view.
Yeah, I mean,
okay,
in some sense, you know, and again, it's not a word I used, so I think you were kind of imputing something to me that I didn't say. Now, do I think those people are wrong? Yes, I think they're wrong. Do I think that their ideas are being promoted by a certain group and coming from a certain direction? I mean, I think most of us, the reality is that most of us, including me, are heavily influenced by other people in how we think. I think I'm a little more independent, but, you know, everybody thinks they're an independent thinker in this country, and very few of us really are. Ideas don't come from nowhere. You know, but there is no question that people like the Koch brothers, you know, I didn't pull them out of the air. They're spending actual dollars to organize people. I didn't say to fool people. I said to organize people, to mobilize people, which is, you know, a legitimate activity. But at the same time, they try to disguise it. They try to pretend these things come from nowhere. They also try to pretend that a lot of the ideas that they're cultivating are traditional ideas when they're not. For instance, most of the ideas we hear about homosexuality now from a lot of these people on the right are ideas that, in fact, were dreamed up by psychologists in the early 20th century.
I'd love to ask you more about that, but I promised you we were going to talk about your new books.
Right.
And Becky has been waiting for the longest time so patiently on the phone line here from McGackiesville. So, Becky, let's at least get your question before we get on to Larry Yates's newest books.
Well, I guess my thought was a little bit more about the division being really, for me, between open-mindedness and non-open-mindedness. And where I have an issue, and I often say I fall so far left in the spectrum, I'm coming up the right, I'm one of those kind of people, is that it just seems like everybody has the inability to listen to anyone else in terms of really, you know, the way you listen when you would be willing to change your mind if somebody made sense. And that on the left and on the right, I see this just inability to hear what anybody else says.
Well, if I could speak to that, I put the ability to listen and the respect for other people at the center of what I do. But I feel like the people that I'm especially listening to are the people who are oppressed or in trouble. For instance, a good friend of mine who's serving life plus 30 years for a very minor offense, who's African-American. And I'm going to listen to and respect her. And for the people that dismiss that, drug war, you know, let's lock them up. It's very hard for me to respect those people because they're not listening to anything. You know?
Right, but I mean, I find that truly on both sides. I truly find it just as much, you know, like I said, I probably would consider myself a leftist, to be honest, but I do find that a lot of times that everybody just has a really hard time, you know?
Well, I think some of it is that my politics are not really, I don't watch television. I'm not active in the presidential campaign. I have a preference, but I'm not active. You know, my politics are mostly with individual people at the local level, or sometimes even the national level, with individual people.
Right, and I mean, I think that's our only option at this point to get anywhere.
Right.
Becky, thank you so very much for your call. We are running short on time, but you certainly have reminded me that it is my goal to do better at listening, and I don't always achieve that goal, so I really love the fact that you called to remind us of how important that is. Thanks so much. So, two books, Larry Lamar Yates.
Yep.
Both just out. One fiction, the other nonfiction. Nonfiction is titled The Scalawag Scholar's Notes on Virginia. The novel is titled Blood Root Cantons, An Alternative Story of Virginia and the Blue Ridge. Which one are you going to talk about first?
Well, let's start with the novel just because it may be a little harder to get the idea of it. This is a novel of what people call alternative history. That is, this is something that could have happened but didn't. In 1729, this did happen. There was a group of people who escaped from slavery in Caroline County, Virginia. They were well organized. They had tools. They had weapons. They went out into the Blue Ridge. They set up a little village. This all actually happened. But then they got captured and were either killed or taken back to slavery. My novel takes that situation. Of course, we don't know a lot about these people, so I had to make up some things about them. Takes those people, has them, have them encounter some Shawnee people who were, you know, at times in the area, who know more about the land and how to deal with things. They cooperate, they survive. Then I have the Moravians, Mennonites, Quakers, the Anabaptist groups, and so on, coming down from Pennsylvania and coming into the mix. So it's kind of a little, somebody called it a utopia, but at the same time, these are all real people that were there. I try to describe them in ways that are historically accurate. And there were communities, the Seminole Indians, for instance, were a community of escaped slaves and of people from various native tribes in Florida. They were a community that never existed except in reaction to the white man. So this would have been similar. So, you know, I have some fun with, you know, how people interact and also how the heck can they survive against the overwhelming military force of the British. They follow kind of a Burr Fox strategy. And I think
I never imagined you before, Larry, as a fiction writer. And mm-hmm. It was fun to see how creative you were with the dialogue. But let me get to what I was not surprised to see was this new book of nonfiction, The Scalawag Scholar's Notes on Virginia. Big, long, thick book, although the type is fairly big, so it's not hard on the eyes. What's the point here?
Well, it's about the Virginia gentleman, basically, and the myth of kind of Virginia exceptionalism, that this is something very cool about the Virginia gentleman. He's civil, he's nice, he loves the land. He treats people well, when in fact, you know, the history is privilege and abuse and greed right from the beginning. And it's fascinating to see how the story has been renewed, how the propaganda has been renewed, because we're talking about the kind of propaganda that only works if you don't even know it's propaganda. If you just think, well, this is just the way things are here in Virginia, you know, it's nice. Even though you personally may be having a lousy time, you think, well, overall, it's really nice. Well, you know, a lot of things are great. I've been living here.
So from your perspective, this several hundred page book is a myth buster.
Yeah, I call it the frauds. I talk about the 21 frauds and fables of the Virginia gentleman.
I want to read just a couple of paragraphs here from early on in the book. I think this is page 29. Quote, here in Virginia, the U.S. wars in Indochina and Iraq were planned. The arming of fundamentalist Afghanis and Saudis was dreamed up. The overthrowing of democratic governments from Guatemala to Iran to the Congo was coordinated. Today, the heirs, in style if not in fact, of the original group of settlers and legal bandits are still in power. These heirs, the Virginia gentlemen, still believe they can do no wrong and that the inferior classes and groups can do no right without their guidance. They still believe that whatever enriches them is proper, end quote. from Larry Lamar Yates' new book, The Scalawag Scholar's Notes on Virginia. Larry, is it fair to say that there's some anger in your view of the world today, and that motivates some of your political activism?
You know, it's not really huge at this point. You know, I've been doing this for a long time. When you're young, you're angry, you're passionate, you know, but the fact is, this is something that I can do well, you know, I enjoy doing. By the way, I was a fiction writer before I was an activist. When I was a kid, I thought I was writing poetry. That's how I thought of myself. But, you know, this is just something that I like to do, is to work for justice. And, you know, I go do it like anybody else goes and does what they care about.
Larry, whether somebody wholeheartedly agrees with you or just vehemently disagrees with you, I think they got to admit, every time we get you walking in the room, you get us thinking. Thanks so much for that. Our guest has been the longtime community organizer and political activist Larry Lamar Yates. Once again, his two new books are titled The Scalawag Scholar's Notes on Virginia, plus Bloodroot Cantons, An Alternative Story of Virginia and the Blue Ridge. Larry, thanks so much for your time. You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And when you go to that page, within a few minutes, we're going to post some information about upcoming book signings that Larry is having in different communities across Virginia. Thanks so much for tuning in.